Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today, well, I really don't need to introduce him, as regular listeners to NPR are going to instantly recognize his voice. But I'm delighted to be speaking with David Greene, one of the hosts of NPR's Morning Edition. David's been a Morning Edition host since 2012. Prior to that, he was a foreign correspondent for NPR, based in Moscow, and he also covered the White House for NPR. He's won many awards for his work in journalism. David, it's a delight to have you on the program.
It's great to be here, Grant. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Let me start with something personal. Listeners are hearing this a little bit after the fact, but you and I are talking on the day after the stories about the Las Vegas shootings came out. And you were on the air yesterday from Washington reporting on that. I'm sure that was a hard morning for you.
It was a hard morning. You know, seeing such a horrific event unfold while you're trying to do your job and be on live radio for hours at a time, you know, it's not something I haven't faced before, but we're human beings. And some of those scenes, which we were playing in the studio over and over again, they were just horrific. And, you know, we've all been to concerts. And I'm going to think differently when I go to a concert now. And it's horrible to say that. But, you know, these were people who were in Vegas to listen to country music and listen to Jason Aldean and have a good night. And for one person to totally change that and to cause so much, I mean, tragedy and death, it's pretty awful.
And I knew that I was going to be talking to you when I was listening to those reports, and my mind went to the conversation we were going to have, and it got me thinking about this. Is there one day or one story in your entire career that stands out for you as the hardest one for you to do?
You know, I hard is there have been a lot of hard days. And I'm sure this is a place where many Americans go when they hear this a question like this. But, you know, 9/11 was a day that I'll never forget, having to struggle with that tension between being a person and being a journalist. You know, I was in my house actually in Baltimore, and it was my moving day. I was moving my stuff down to a new apartment in Washington, D.C. I was covering the White House. You know, I just started covering the White House when George W. Bush came in, and, you know, saw just the very earliest images rush down to Washington. And my job, you know, every single reporter I think involved had specific duties. You know, we were all like little pieces of the larger quilt, was to cover every single second of George W. Bush's day. And I wasn't with him, you know, flying around and getting back to Washington, but I was in Washington and, you know, but had to pay attention to every single White House briefing. I was making calls to find out exactly what the president was doing. It was like every second tick-tock of his day, that's what I was focused on. And I was writing my story. And finally, you know, I was done my day at like 11 o'clock and I met my best friend, Chandler, who lived in Washington, D.C. at the time. He was my college roommate and my greatest friend. And we went to this bar, and I think everyone else in the bar had hours and hours to at least start to internalize what had happened. Mm-hmm. As a journalist, I didn't have that because I was like just constantly, you know, following the president, and then just sat there and just cried uncontrollably seeing some of the later images. Mm-hmm. And people at the bar were just coming up to me and asking me what was wrong. And, you know, I don't know, I felt like I was just hours behind in terms of reacting to that. And that's the day that stands out. But, you know, I'm sure people who rushed to Vegas to cover that story are both being humans and journalists at the same time.
I wanted to ask you a few questions about the larger role of the media and how it relates to politics, particularly in recent months. And, you know, first of all, the job that you and your news reporting colleagues have, it's always been critical to a functioning democracy. But I wonder whether you feel like your job has become even more important during the last year.
I think our job is obviously always important. I think that in the last year or so, in a very partisan environment, our job is being called into question and being scrutinized in ways that I never remember in my career. And I think there are pressures on us that I've never felt so intensely in my career. And I think this doesn't come from just, you know, just the right or just the left. I think we're getting a lot of pressure to be something we're not. I think there's a lot of pressure to be advocates. I think there are complaints from both sides that we're, you know, being too quote unquote neutral or whatever the words you're going to use. And it's a moment, you know, it's a real inflection point, I think, for this profession. And, you know, I'll have people tell me, you know, if you don't do your job better, if you don't take a position, you're going to lead us down a dangerous road, this country. And I don't know. I continue to so believe in this institution and so believe that journalism is just a pillar of this democracy that to abdicate that responsibility to be fair and to be accurate and to do all the things and remain committed to all the values that I learned, you know, as a young journalist, if we give all that up, that's the most dangerous thing to this democracy. But this has been it's a difficult time, and we have to take it very seriously.
And I was wondering in that same vein whether you and your colleagues, particularly I guess in terms of editorial decisions, but whether you have had to think harder and have more conversations among yourselves about what the professional standards are and ought to be, what ethics in journalism is all about. Have you been looking at yourselves more in the last few months?
Yeah, I don't think the questions are new. I just think they're coming up a lot more because so many people are talking about it and challenging us. You know, so the foundation of this, I don't think, has changed. I have always been proud of our work and my work and feel that I am fair and am listening to different perspectives and different voices and just giving people the space and a feeling of security to be able to say how they feel and to think out loud and to not necessarily feel like they have to have an opinion on something that is well formed. I mean, one of the most important things we do is we create space for conversation, and it's so critical. And so that hasn't changed. But people keep asking me now, what could you be doing better to defend yourselves against all of this, these questions and criticism of our business? And I honestly think the best thing we can do is just to continue to create the content that we create. It's to do the show that we're doing. It is for me to be able to come to you and to say, you know, I appreciate all of these probing questions about our profession, whether we're accurate and balanced. You know what? Listen to our show tomorrow morning, and then we can talk about it. And the best case we can make for what we're doing is to keep creating the content we're creating.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with David Green, host of NPR's Morning Edition. I had a much more specific question on this topic, and it's something I wonder about a lot. When presidents in the past have made statements regarding public policies or initiatives or public issues, what they say is, by definition, and for good reason, news. I mean, it counts as news. Mm-hmm. The president represents the executive branch. What he communicates matters. But this president is, I think, a lot looser than previous presidents about how he communicates. Twitter would obviously be the primary example here. But he seems to use that medium both as a way of issuing a message from the White House and also in the same way that everyone else does it, which is to think out loud, to poke, to prod. So I'm curious to hear whether you and your colleagues have had conversations about what to report as news in this regard.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as soon as it became clear that he was going to be making important statements in 140 characters, we had to decide how to...
Can you be a statesman in 140 characters?
Yeah, so, of course, that came up very quickly. And, you know, early on in the administration, and this happens whenever there's a new president in office, you know, anything he or she does in the very beginning feels important because, you know, the country is trying to feel this person out. And you know, the early days of administration are important no matter who's in that office. And so, you know, as weeks went on and we were updating our show with every new tweet, we started to ask that question, you know, what's important here?
It often leads your news broadcast.
It often leads our news broadcast, but I think we have to be really careful about why it's leading our news broadcast. You know, and on one hand, this is just a new way for a White House to communicate, and it's a way that a lot of people in this country are communicating. And so, you know, it's not like just because something is on Twitter, it's not news. You know, if it had come from a press secretary emailing a statement out in a previous administration, just because it's on Twitter now, does that make it not news? No. Just because it's social media, is it not news? No. We're gonna report it as we should report it. I think we just have to make sure we're applying the same standards of news judgment for tweets as we would be for, you know, a statement from the press secretary. You know, I get a lot of – my inbox is so full of statements from the White House, and we're not reporting on every single, you know, position on HR bill number whatever, or we're extending, you know, this age-old law one more year. I'm not – that's not news. So if that's what the president is tweeting, you know, we're going to apply the same standards. If he is coming out and saying something about Puerto Rico at a moment when, you know, an island has been devastated by a hurricane, I think that what the president of the United States is saying about Puerto Rico, however he's saying it, is important.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with David Greene, host of NPR's Morning Edition. David, you alluded to this a little bit in the first half of the program, but the problem of fake news, and let me make it clear, what I mean by this is the real fake news, not the real news that's called fake.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Does the proliferation of fake news and the social media manipulations require the news media to take a more proactive role than it would in the past in debunking and fact-checking stories that are circulating in public?
I mean, we have to just be really careful that what we are putting out there is the truth, period. So I think if every example of fake news that gets put out into the world – do we have some responsibility to mine social media for fake news and debunk every single piece of fake news, no matter its importance? No. But if fake news becomes part of the political conversation, if something that is grossly inaccurate is beginning to influence policymakers, is beginning to influence the White House, is beginning to influence how people view their elected leaders in some significant way, absolutely. It is absolutely our responsibility. It's our responsibility to tell the truth in the moment. So if there is an important story or issue out there and fake news is beginning to proliferate and influence people, then of course. But I think it's a larger issue to me, Grant. It's not just fake news. It is that in this environment now, social media has been wonderful in so many ways. It's a natural evolution in a country to find new forms of technology and new forms of communication. You know, we use social media as an incredible tool at NPR. It's a way to reach new audiences. It's a way to get our content out. But what worries me the most is if the definition of news and journalism is becoming muddled and complicated. It bothers me so much when I hear someone say, "I get my news from this podcast," if it's a podcast that has an absolutely clear political bent. I mean, and I'm thinking about both the right and the left. Like, go to those podcasts, listen, have fun. I mean, enjoy it. And, you know, I just – they're great. I mean, I'm not saying that people with strong political opinions, experience in government shouldn't be out there having podcasts. Like, it's fantastic for the conversation. It's entertaining. You can get insights in that way. But if you start thinking that that is your news – that you are getting, you know, information and fact in that way, that starts to worry me. And that's on us. That's where we have a real responsibility to make sure that people understand, you know, what news is. Be entertained, have fun, listen to different points of view, all well and good. It's great. I love podcasts myself. I think they're fantastic. I love Twitter myself. I use it all the time. I use Facebook. These are all great platforms. But make sure we still understand as a country what news is still today.
So you mentioned the left and the right. NPR, and I think it's fair to say this, but you take issue with me if you want on it. I think NPR is often regarded as the more progressive or left wing of the mainstream media.
I would take issue with us being that. I'm not going to take issue with you saying
perception.
The perception is out there.
It's
a perception I like to challenge a lot, especially having spent, you know, I spent 8 years covering a Republican administration and spent a lot of time with Republican voters around the country. And we would talk about NPR and they would immediately have the perception that we were, you know, the left. And I would almost love to describe to them, you know, a lot of what our shows sound like and how they take different points of view into, into consideration. You can hear, I would just tell people, please listen and then tell me if you still think that way.
So given that perception, though, I wondered whether you and your colleagues think of that when you're making editorial decisions, when you're thinking about how to frame stories, when you're thinking about what stories to cover. Has that ever come into the conversation? Hey, people think of us this way. Maybe we should be careful here or there.
Are we aware of it? Yes. If we have a Republican lawmaker on our show, do I think about, wow, people who think that we are on the left are going to hear this and maybe realize that we're not, that we bring on all different points of view? Sure. And does that make me proud? Absolutely. If you are realizing that we are not in any way left or right, that makes me happy. So am I aware of it? Yes. Do I let it guide our editorial decisions? No. Mm-hmm. I think that I wouldn't, if I did, I wouldn't want to be working where I work.
If you just joined us, you're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is NPR's David Greene. You were on Air Force One with George W. Bush when he visited the Gulf Coast after Hurricane Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
So I was curious to know what your take is on President Trump's reaction to and handling of the recent hurricanes. Not to put you on the spot.
Not to put me on the spot at all. It's not my job to personally judge how a president's responding to something. I mean, I think you know that would be what I would say, because that's the truth. I will say that when I was with George W. Bush as he flew, you know, just a few thousand feet over New Orleans, he was very criticized for that. Was that a miscalculation that made him seem like he was not actually interested in what was going on, you know, in the city itself and on the ground? That was one of the narratives. I think that we were all wondering when we were sitting in Crawford, Texas, why it had taken the number of hours and days that it had for him to do something. And we were asking a lot of questions about that.
Now we're having those questions again.
Those questions again. But flying low over the Gulf Coast, I think when you are any president, the pressures to get it right in that moment, I mean, you don't want to go into the middle of New Orleans with your presidential entourage at a moment when people are still being rescued and people are still dying and the city's underwater. But you're under enormous pressure to do something. And so, you know, in retrospect, can people debate whether George W. Bush should have flown on Air Force One over the city looking down at this devastation from the seat of a jumbo jet? Sure, you can have that conversation. In that moment, did I think that there were, you know, there was a lack of compassion on the part of that White House? In that moment, I think that would be really unfair, mm-hmm. because I think they were trying to figure out, you know, how to get a grasp of what was happening on the ground, and this is what they decided in that moment. This president, I don't know. I think in the moment when there's a natural disaster, there are going to be frustrations and a feeling of being ignored by Washington. And I think it's going to take time to sort out the decisions that the Trump administration has made about these hurricanes, about Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. There's some really tough questions being asked about whether those islands are being treated as parts of the continental United States would be treated. And I think those questions have to be asked. I think that the handling of these disasters will demand a lot of scrutiny in terms of commitment. And that's going to happen. And when that debate happens, I'll really welcome voices on all sides on our air.
Now, you also have experience in Russia, and you've spoken with Russian leaders in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So I was
curious. Not a lot. They're not real keen on doing interviews with the still waiting for Vladimir Putin to.
Well, okay, that was good. All right, I won't ask that question.
Yeah, I'm waiting for him. It's.
But I am curious to know what you think is going on with the possibility of Russian and what looks like evidence of Russian interference in the election and our politics. What's your sense of this, based on what you know of the Russians?
You know, when I was in Moscow, a few months ago, we were trying to figure out, you know, if there had been some sort of organized, orchestrated infiltration of the U.S. election and whether Vladimir Putin had been directly involved or not. It's just this is an impossible story to fully grasp. I'll say you can come up with all different scenarios about where this is going. When you hear people who are committed to the idea that there was interference here, I mean, you've got to realize this would be a foreign government influencing a U.S. presidential election. I think it's really important to step back and think if someone had told us that 3 years ago, hey, by the way, the Kremlin is actually going to get involved and decide who wins, who becomes president of the United States. We'd think either that was absurd or the scariest thing we'd ever heard of, probably both. Hmm. But on the other side, you know, if you're a supporter of President Trump right now, you know, the argument that nothing has been proven in terms of Trump or his inner circle being involved in any way, it's important to remember that. Mm-hmm. You know, as the facts begin to come out, you know, if that is proven at some point, I mean, that is hugely significant. And so these are incredibly important questions that are being asked in this investigation. But when you listen to someone who is backing up the president saying that nothing has been proven and saying that you know, people are drawing conclusions too quickly, I think they have a fair point too.
So we only have about a minute or so left, but I did want to ask you, is there a story that you've done that sticks out in your mind and your career that if you could have a do-over on, you'd like to have that do-over?
God, that's really hard. That's a hard question. I'll have to think about that. You know, I look at my time in Russia, and you know, I reported on Vladimir Putin and some of his, I don't want to say antics, but what he did to create an image of himself for Russians, what we might call fake news today, you know, going and you know, creating the impression that he was helping ravaged villages that were ravaged by wildfires, going after protesters, talking about it being okay for a protester to be clubbed on the head if they didn't have a right to be out there. You know, I could have been tougher on him, and I wish I'd interviewed him and been able to ask those tough questions.
That was David Green. David, this has been both a professional and a personal thrill for me. Thanks.
Well, I really enjoyed it, too. Thank you.
I have a favor to ask of you now.
Yeah, yeah.
Would you do the closing? It's going to be better coming from you.
Closing of your show?
Yeah.
That's a huge honor. You sure you want that?
I do.
Yes. All right. You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
Wonderful. Thanks.
Thank you.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.